WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We open this archive edition of our show with a recent interview about city streets and city politics. These are the subjects Steve Lopez writes about in his popular column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Now Lopez has joined the ranks of newspaper columnists turned novelists. Fellow columnist and novelist Pete Hamill praised Lopez's first novel for its style, dark humor, and sense of tragedy. It's called Third in Indiana, and it's set in a neighborhood known as the Badlands, where the streets are owned by drug dealers. As the novel opens, Gabriel, a 14-year-old drug dealer, has run away from home, leaving his mother no clues to explain his disappearance. Now she spends her nights riding a bicycle, searching the streets for him. In this passage, Gabriel is standing in a shadow, watching his mother pedal toward him on a bicycle much too small for her large body.
Maybe he should have gotten her a bigger bicycle. It had been a birthday present 6 months ago. Get some exercise, he had told her. She had put on so much weight since his father walked out on them, without a word or a warning. Get some exercise, some fresh air, whatever, just get out of the house. A person could suffocate in there. It was filled with so much unspoken disappointment. But Gabriel never really expected her to ride the bike. She'd be too self-conscious, for one thing. And she'd wonder where he got the money. He didn't know her as well as he thought he did. Not only was she riding the bicycle, but she was riding it in the middle of the night, looking for him. Damn, Gabriel thought. She shouldn't be out here at this hour. Not in this neighborhood. Gabriel was 14, a dark sliver of a boy with slow, sad eyes that could stay sad through a smile. He was going to be a lady killer, his mother had been telling him since before he knew what it meant, and she had said it again a week ago, the night before he ran away. His first thought was to run to her now. His second was to just run. His right foot made the decision, a slow, backward step on the toe of his sneaker, and then he wheeled and was gone, lost in the darkness beyond the L as a train rattled over Philadelphia rooftops, past the steamed windows of sleeping babies, and past corners owned and ruled by drug gangs. Ophelia Santoro of Diamond Street fought the bicycle to a stop at the intersection of Lehigh and Kensington, her chest rising with each breath. The cops and prosecutors had a name for this part of town, which took in areas of Kensington and North Philadelphia, and was good for several shootings a night and a drug trade that rivaled the gross national product of a dozen small nations. They called it the Badlands. If her husband were still around, he'd be the one out here searching the Badlands. If her husband were still around, Gabriel wouldn't have run away. That was the way she looked at it. The world wasn't worth living in, Ophelia thought. If it was a place where Gabriel could be dead and her husband could be alive. If that were the case, she'd have to find a way to get word to him. He had a right to know.
Steve Lopez, thanks for reading that. How were you first introduced to this part of the city?
Well, I got to Philadelphia about 10 years ago. I was born and raised in the San Francisco area, and I came to the Philadelphia Inquirer as a general assignment reporter. And one of my early assignments took me to that neighborhood.
What did you see there that surprised you?
I was immediately horrified, intrigued. I couldn't get enough of it. I was struck by the complete devastation. It looked to me like it was the end of the world. Houses were literally crumbling. Glass all over the streets. Graffiti on all of the buildings. Kids selling drugs openly and doing so in the shadows of these shut-down factories. And although I had seen poverty, I had seen, you know, urban problems in San Jose, California, and in Oakland, and in San Francisco, I had seen nothing that came close in any way to the depth of the devastation in the neighborhood.
What were the stories that kept bringing you back to that neighborhood?
I guess I was fascinated by the fact that in the middle of all of that, there are people just struggling to hold on. The people living in fear, people afraid to let their children out of the house because they might get hit by a stray bullet, people who can't remember the last time they made it through a night without hearing gunshots. And you hear these stories over and over and over again, and you realize that these are, in a way, urban heroes. These are people who If they could get out, certainly would, but are trapped. You have situations like maybe somebody bought a house for $15,000 or $20,000 10 years ago, 12 years ago. Today, in some of these neighborhoods, that house is worth nothing. You couldn't give it away. And so they're stuck. They're stuck with gangs working on the corner. They're stuck with unemployment that gets to 50% and above. They're stuck with high schools where each year begins, say, with 500 freshmen and 100 seniors, because kids just don't make it. They either get into the drug trade or they're cut down, you know, by bullets, one thing or another. And I think what fascinated me was that there were so many people there who were just struggling to survive, people for whom the future is just tomorrow. Nobody who's thinking about where they're going to go on vacation next year or what kind of a job, you know, maybe they should work toward, and what college they're going to go to. People just struggling to hold on.
How much were you able to get to know some of the really young drug dealers, people like Gabriel on the book?
Well, it's difficult. It's difficult. One time I was on I went with police on a sweep of the neighborhood, and they made some arrests, and I got an opportunity to talk to a 16-year-old who they arrested. And I asked him what the situation was, and I spoke to him in a jail cell. He had been arrested for selling drugs, and I asked him how he got into it. And he said he had gotten in a couple years ago as a lookout. That's how you begin, and maybe you make $50 a day or maybe $100 a day. And he knew that it was wrong. He knew that he shouldn't be doing it. But other kids were doing it, and he lived on a block where just about everybody has a piece of the action, one way or another. He later got a job helping out a landscaper, and he was making some money, and he thought, and it was important in his household because his father had just had a heart attack, lost his job, there were no medical benefits, his mother was trying to take care of the rest of the kids. He felt that he had to be the breadwinner, and the landscaper laid him off, and he would sit in his house and look outside and hear her kids his own age making $150 a day. So he began to do it, and he got pretty good at it. There are kids who actually excel at being drug dealers. And he said, I said to him, how long do you think you're going to live doing this? And he said, oh, not long, maybe a couple years. And I said, and then what's going to happen? And he said, I'm going to be shot and killed, probably right here. And I said, well, why do you do it? And he said, what is my alternative? How is my family going to eat? What if my father needs medicine? And you hear these kinds of stories on a regular basis.
Why did you want to write a novel? You've been a columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer for about 8 years, is it?
It's 8 years, 9 years, yeah. I wanted to write a novel because growing up, I never read. I grew up in a house where my father drove a Wonder Bread truck. My mother took care of the kids and had dinner ready every night. And then we watched sitcoms for about 4 hours. And I was not exposed to books. Nobody in my family had been exposed to books. I went to school, became a sports writer, and then switched over and became a news reporter. And when I did that, I met people who knew about things that I had never heard of, people who had traveled the world and were talking about books and museums and music and things that I was exposed to a world that I never knew existed. And I started to play catch-up. In my late 20s and my early 30s, I began reading the classics, the books that you're supposed to read when you're in high school. I actually made it through high school and college literally without reading a single book. If there was an assignment, I would read the flap and I would just kind of skate through and, you know, just kind of fake it. Fake it till you make it.
You must have been pretty good at faking it.
Well, you know, I had some writing skills, but I had no interest in writing a book. I didn't know that books were ideas. And when I started to read, one of the books that I came across was To Kill a Mockingbird. And I read it at a time in my life when I had a true appreciation for literature. And when I read that, I thought, this has got to be one of the most humane and noble acts in the 20th century, the writing of this book. Not so much because of the way that it's written, but because of what it says and how it says it. And I knew then that I wanted to... even more than learn how to play the guitar, I wanted to see if I could write a novel someday. So it began with that. It began with, I guess, out of anger a little bit, a bit of anger about not having been exposed to books early on and feeling as if I missed so much. Well, not only am I going to read them, I'm going to write them. That was sort of the attitude that I that I took.
My guest is Steve Lopez. He's a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of the new novel, Third in Indiana. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with columnist and novelist Steve Lopez. You had a recent column in the Inquirer about parking in South Philadelphia. And South Philadelphia is where one of the characters in your novel is from.
Right.
Italian neighborhood. A lot of powerful people in Philadelphia politics come from that neighborhood. And describe the parking things that you tried for this column.
Well, I had, in Philadelphia, there is this history of certain people living by different rules than people in other neighborhoods. North Philadelphia in Philadelphia happens to be primarily black. South Philadelphia happens to be primarily white. And there is this history in the city that if you park in the middle of the street in South Philadelphia, we're talking about a four-lane thoroughfare, and down the middle of that is you have double yellow lines running parallel and wide enough that a car can fit in the middle. In South Philadelphia, you can park in the middle of the street. It's okay. Technically, it's against the law, but it's not enforced. And I was aware of that, of course, and was aware as well that in North Philadelphia, there are no cars in the middle of the street. So I had wanted to do this for quite a while, to take my car up to North Philadelphia and just park it in the middle of the street and see what happened, see how long it took to get a ticket or to get towed or whatever. So I drove up there one day, and I parked, and I got out, and I stood on the sidewalk, and I walked up the block, and I don't think I made it back down to the other side, and I saw somebody writing a ticket for it. And it was 7 minutes. In 7 minutes, I got a ticket. All right, got in the car, drove to South Philadelphia, parked in the middle of the street. And I waited 7 minutes. I waited a half hour. And I decided to celebrate that I would go into a little restaurant there, had a meatball sandwich to celebrate that, you know, we were up to an hour now. came out of the restaurant. The car is still there, no ticket. And so I took the subway and went home. And the next morning I checked on it, and the next night, and for 15 days went to see if they would give me a ticket or if it would have gotten towed or anything. And it was untouched.
My favorite part of that column, like many people in Philadelphia, I have a favorite restaurant in South Philadelphia. It's a little hard to park there because on every block there's at least one or two spaces that are cordoned off for disabled parking. And I've always thought, like, how many handicapped people can there possibly be living in this three-block radius?
That is another scam in Philadelphia. You get those through your ward leader. And, you know, we have that system here, the old machine.
So it's a way of just reserving a spot for yourself.
There you go. Yeah.
You have a column about a city commissioner in Philadelphia, Marge Tartaglione, who handles elections.
Right.
And this was after an article came out in the Philadelphia Inquirer about how the city is spending more for parts and maintenance of its voting machines than nearly any other city.
Right.
So what you did was you transcribed word for word what she had to say in an interview that was recorded by a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Right.
And, gee, maybe I can get you to read some of that.
Okay, this is from a two-hour interview that an Inquirer reporter did, and he asked her a question. He was asking her about why do you need so many mechanics to fix these things? Why are they paid such overtime, and why do the parts cost so much? And Marge said, "It's like my husband. He used to have a gas station, all right? When they were a car came, a new car, they'd lift up the hood. Everything was metric tools. Now, it cost them a fortune to go out to buy the metric tools. Somebody says, 'Oh, come on, you could use these.' He says, 'Yeah,' and strip the bearings or strip whatever it is. Now, these voting machines are antiquated. They're antiquated. Now, how old is this machine? All right, 45. If you were a mechanic 45 years ago, the younger generation, everything has changed. You take the new machines, you take the computers, and it's getting harder and harder. Like it's getting harder and harder to get parts." Or to complete a sentence was what I wrote at the end of that paragraph.
Now, is that cruel?
Is it cruel?
Yeah. To transcribe that and just mock her for...
I think what's cruel is that we have a public official who can't answer a simple question and who presides over a system that was the subject of a state investigation. An election was overturned. We have these things going on, and she and the others involved have done very little to reform it or to change the fact that it's just a patronage house. It's a way for them to hire employees. And she does not think or speak like I think a responsible public official should. And I think this paragraph is an example of her, you know, being evasive. She's not going to answer the question. And I think, I don't think it's cruel. I think it's important to just call her on it, to say, look, where's the answer? You're rambling on. This doesn't make a lot of sense. What's the point?
You once took her to a shopping mall and did a column on that. What was that about?
Well, I was at the Democratic National Convention in Atlanta. I guess it was 1988. And I was following around the Pennsylvania delegates. And she, I don't remember if she was a delegate or an alternate, but she and a few other public officials, including two who prior to that time had gone to Las Vegas for a National League of Cities convention and were followed by a reporter who reported that they spent most of the time playing nickel slots in a casino and missing all of these workshops and symposiums. So here are the three of them in the bar when workshops and meetings are going on at the Democratic National Convention. And I looked at them and I said, what are you doing? And they said something like, well, you know, the meetings are kind of boring. And I thought to myself, well, what story can I get here? I said, shopping. They'd probably like to go shopping. And I had passed a shopping mall. And I said, what do you say? If I can get a car, you want to go to the shopping mall? And, you know, they jumped up off the bar stools. And I went and called the office and I said, is it okay if I rent a limo to take, you know, the Boom Boom Sisters and Marge Tartaglione to a shopping mall? And they said, sure, go ahead. So I took them to the mall, and the point of it was that here yes. they should have been, you know, representing the city, attending the workshops, whether they were alternates or not, and they were, you know, lounging around the lobby and drinking, and you know, perfectly happy and willing to get in a limo and go shopping.
Gee, isn't that a little bit like, what's the word when a cop propositions a prostitute?
Entrapment.
Entrapment, thank you.
Well, shopping mall, that was definite entrapment on my part. I knew that the words shopping mall would get them. And I don't know. I mean, it's I don't think that I handled it in a cruel way. I handled it in a lighthearted sort of tongue-in-cheek way. And they knew what was going on. I mean, they participated.
So what did they think of your column?
Well, I don't remember whether they responded. I think one of them said, well, you gave us a few knocks, but it was kind of fun. It's a city, believe me, it's a city without shame.
One other column I have to ask you about. You went to a barber to get a mob hairdo.
Right.
How did you find the barber, and what was the inspiration for this column?
Well, when I first got to Philadelphia, that's another thing I was fascinated with, was the mafia and how it flourished and how, you know, everybody seemed to know, hey, see that guy walking down the street? That's a mobster. And I forget whether the haircut was before or after I got thrown out of a mafia party celebrating a murder acquittal. I went to the Four Seasons and was literally thrown out of the party. But I got the reason for the haircut story was I was looking through the paper one day. And it was a day when about 15 mobsters were rounded up, indicted, arrested, whatever. And we had mugshots in the Philadelphia Inquirer. And I noticed that everybody in the mugshot had the same haircut. And so I called an attorney, a Philadelphia attorney, who represents a lot of them. And I said, Bobby, Steve Lopez of the Inquirer, working on a story here on the mafia. He said, what angle are you working on? And I said, the haircuts. I want to know where they get their haircuts. And he said to me, I had not talked to him before that, and he said to me, words I'll never forget, would you come out of a tree or what? And I when I do interviews on the phone, I you know, I'm typing there on the other end, and I can't type that fast, let me tell you. So I said, I wasn't even sure what he said, so I said, excuse me, could you repeat that? Would you come out of a tree or what? And I said, okay, out of a tree or what? Well, thank you. The thing is, Bobby, do you know where I can get a haircut like that? And he said, what are you, stupid? And I said, you know, I've just been all my life a step or two behind the fashion trends. And I thought if I get the haircut that everybody else in town has, you know, maybe it'll change my life. And he started to laugh at that. And he said, all right, here's where you go. And he told me what barbershop to go to. So I went down there and they said, what do you want? And I said, I want the mob do. And that was all I needed to say. He got out the scissors and started cutting.
Now, did the mob do look like a hairpiece, but it was the real thing?
Well, the thing is, short, brushed back. See, back, I had more hair at the time, and it worked a little better. Right now, I'm not sure that a mob do would look very good on me. But it's...
You might need a little bit of the hair piece up front, is that what you're saying?
That's right, that's right. And it's just a short brush cut, and it's all combed straight back. Yeah, it looks very sharp, very sharp.
Now, I believe you have a second novel in the works that's going to be about what you describe as hack Philadelphia politicians. There's obviously something about a certain kind of politician in Philadelphia that really interests you, and I'd like to see if you could describe what it is.
Well, I guess it's the last of the machine politicians that I'm intrigued by. At first, you find it the whole thing repulsive, that they play by this whole different set of rules, that it's okay to break the law if a constituent benefits. It's okay to put somebody on a ghost payroll if it's really a good kid. You know, it's okay to lie on an application and get somebody a college loan if in the end, well, he's going to benefit. Maybe he comes back and the neighborhood benefits. There is that school in Philadelphia. And as I said, when you first come here and you look at it, you think, my God, these are dinosaurs. You know, it's like Boss Tweed kind of stuff. When you get to know them, some of them, you find that there's some charm that goes with it. They maybe have some chromosomes bent or something. I mean, they don't quite think right, but they have a great deal of charm, and they really believe that that's the system that works. The system that works best is where instead of calling the streets department to fix your street, you call the guy on the corner who happens to be a committee man, who knows the ward leader, who can call this guy in Harrisburg, the state capital, and get this thing done like that. And along that route, everybody's getting some kind of a kickback. Everybody's got a piece of the action. And it sort of keeps them in business. And I'm fascinated by that. It's almost gone in American cities. And I want to write this novel is, in a way, I guess, a denouncement and a tribute. It's sort of a goodbye to those old-time machine politicians.
Steve Lopez, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Steve Lopez is a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. His new novel is called Third in Indiana. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.